Chapter 5. The angel at the grave. The house stood a few yards back from the elm-shaded village street, and that semi-publicity sometimes cited as a democratic protest against old-world standards of domestic exclusiveness. This candid exposure to the public eye is more probably a result of the gregariousness which, in the New England bosom, oddly coexists with a shrinking from direct social contact. Most of the inmates of such houses preferring that furtive intercourse which is the result of observations through shuttered windows and a categorical acquaintance with the neighboring clotheslines. The house, however, faced its public with a difference. For 60 years it had written itself with a capital letter, had self-consciously squared itself in the eye of an admiring nation. The most searching inroads of village intimacy hardly counted in a household that opened on the universe, and a lady whose doorbell was at any moment liable to be rung by visitors from London or Vienna was not likely to flutter upstairs when she observed a neighbor tipping over. The solitary inmate of the Anson house owed this injuration of the social texture to the most conspicuous accident in her annals. The fact that she was the only granddaughter of the great Orestes Anson. As he had been born, as it were, into a museum, and cradled in a glass case with a label, the first foundations of her consciousness, being built on the rock of her grandfather's celebrity. To a little girl who acquires her earliest knowledge of literature through a reader embellished with fragments of her ancestor's prose, that personage necessarily fills an heroic space in the foreground of life. To communicate with one's past through the impressive medium of print, to have, as it were, a footing in every library in the country, and an acknowledged kinship with that world-diffused clan, the descendants of the great, was to be pledged to a standard of manners that amazingly simplified the lesser relations of life. The village street on which Paulina Anson's youth looked out led to all the capitals of Europe. And over the roads of intercommunication unseen caravans bore back to the elm-shaded house the tribute of an admiring world. Fate seemed to have taken a direct share in fitting Paulina for her part as the custodian of this historic dwelling. It had long been secretly regarded as a citation by the great man's family that he had left no son, and that his daughters were not intellectual. The ladies themselves were the first to lament their deficiency, to own that nature had denied them the gift of making the most of their opportunities. A profound veneration for their parent, and an unswerving faith in his doctrines had not amended their congenital incapacity to understand what he had written. Laura, who had her moments of mute rebellion against destiny, had sometimes thought how much easier it would have been if their progenitor had been a poet. For she could recite, with feeling, portions of the culprit Fay, and of the poems of Mrs. Hemans, and Phoebe, who was more conspicuous for memory than imagination, kept an album filled with elections. But the great man was a philosopher, and to both daughters' respiration was difficult on the cloudy heights of metaphysic. The situation would have been intolerable, but for the fact that, while Phoebe and Laura were still at school, their father's fame had passed from the open ground of conjecture to the chill privacy of certitude. Dr. Anson had in fact achieved one of those anticipated immortalities not uncommon at a time when people were apt to base their literary judgments on their emotions, and when to affect plain food and despise England went a long way toward establishing a man's intellectual preeminence. Thus, when the daughters were called on to strike a filial attitude about their parents' pedestal, there was little to do but to pose gracefully and point upward. And there are spines to which the immobility of worship is not a strain. A legend had by this time crystallized about the great Orestes, and it was of more immediate interest to the public to hear what brand of tea he drank, and whether he took off his boots in the hall, than to rouse the drowsy echo of his dialectic. A great man never draws so near his public as when it has become unnecessary to read his books, and is still interesting to know what he eats for breakfast. as recorders of their parents' domestic habits, as pious scavengers of his waste paper basket, the Misses Anson were unexcelled. They always had an interesting anecdote to impart to the literary pilgrim, and the tact with which, in later years, they intervened between the public and the growing inaccessibility of its idol, sent away many an enthusiast satisfied to have touched the veil before the sanctuary. Still it was felt, especially by old Mrs. Anson, who survived her husband for some years, that Phoebe and Laura were not worthy of their privileges. There had been a third daughter so unworthy of hers that she had married a distant cousin, who had taken her to live in a new Western community, where the works of Orestes Anson had not yet become a part of the civic consciousness. But of this daughter little was said, and she was tacitly understood to be excluded from the family heritage of fame. In time, however, it appeared that the traditional penny with which she had been cut off had been invested to unexpected advantage, and the interest on it, when she died, returned to the Anson house in the shape of a granddaughter who was at once felt to be what Mrs. Anson called a compensation. It was Mrs. Anson's firm belief that the remotest operations of nature were governed by the centripetal force of her husband's greatness, and that Paulina's exceptional intelligence could be explained only on the ground that she was designed to act as the guardian of the family temple. The house, by the time Paulina came to live in it, had already acquired the publicity of a place of worship. Not the perfumed chapel of a romantic idolatry, but the cold, clean, empty meeting house of ethical enthusiasms. The ladies lived on its outskirts, as it were, in cells that left the central fane undisturbed. The very position of the furniture had come to have a ritual significance. The sparse ornaments were the offerings of kindred intellects. The steel engravings by Raffle Morgan marked the via sacra of a European tour, and the black walnut desk with its bronze inkstand modeled on the Pantheon was the altar of this bleak temple of thought. To a child compact of enthusiasms, and accustomed to pasture them on the scanty herbage of a new social soil, the atmosphere of the old house was full of floating nourishment. In the compressed perspective of Paulina's outlook, it stood for a monument of ruined civilizations, and its white portico opened on legendary distances. Its very aspect was impressive to eyes that at first surveyed life from the jigsaw essence of a raw-edged western town. The high-ceilinged rooms, with their paneled walls, their polished mahogany, their portraits of triple-stocked ancestors, and of ringleted emails in crayon, furnished the child with the historic scenery against which a young imagination constructs its vision of the past. To other eyes, the cold, spotless, thinly furnished interior might have suggested the shuttered mind of a maiden lady who associates fresh air and sunlight with dust and discoloration. But it is the eye which supplies the coloring matter, and Paulina's brimmed with the richest hues. Nevertheless, the house did not immediately dominate her. She had her confused outer achings toward other centers of sensation, her vague intuition of a heliocentric system, but the attraction of habit, the steady pressure of example, gradually fixed her roving allegiance, and she bent her neck to the yoke. Vanity had a share in her subjugation, for it had early been discovered that she was the only person in the family who could read her grandfather's works. The fact that she had perused them with delight at an age when, even presupposing a metaphysical bias, it was impossible for her to understand them, seemed to her aunts and grandmother sure evidence of predestination. Paulina was to be the interpreter of the oracle, and the philosophic fumes, so vertiginous to meaner minds, would throw her into the needed condition of clairvoyance. Nothing could have been more genuine than the emotion on which this theory was based. Paulina, in fact, delighted in her grandfather's writings. His sonorous periods, his mystic vocabulary, his bold flights into the rarefied air of the abstract, were thrilling to a fancy unhampered by the need of definitions. This purely verbal pleasure was supplemented later by the excitement of gathering up crumbs of meaning from the rhetorical board. What could have been more stimulating than to construct the theory of a girlish world out of the fragments of this titanic cosmogony? Before Paulina's opinions had reached the stage when ossification sets in, their form was fatally predetermined. The fact that Dr. Anson had died, and that his apotheosis had taken place before his young priestess's induction to the temple, made her ministrations easier and more inspiring. There were no little personal traits such as the great man's manner of helping himself to salt, or the guttural cluck that started the wheels of speech, to distract the eye of young veneration from the central fact of his divinity. A man whom one knows only through a crayon portrait and a dozen yellowing tomes on free will and intuition is at least secure from the belittling effects of intimacy. Paulina thus grew up in a world readjusted to the fact of her grandfather's greatness, and as each organism draws from its surroundings the kind of nourishment most needful to its growth, so from this somewhat colorless conception she absorbed warmth, brightness, and variety. Paulina was the type of woman who transmutes thought into sensation, and nurses a theory in her bosom like a child. In due course Mrs. Anson passed away, no one died in the Anson vocabulary, and Paulina became more than ever the foremost figure of the commemorative group. Laura and Phoebe, content to leave their father's glory in more competent hands, placidly lapsed into needlework and fiction, and their niece stepped into immediate prominence as the chief authority on the great man. Historians who were heading up the period wrote to consult her and to borrow documents. Ladies with inexplicable yearnings begged for an interpretation of phrases which had influenced them, but which they had not quite understood. Critics applied to her to verify some doubtful citation, or to decide some disputed point in chronology, and the great tide of thought and investigation kept up a continuous murmur on the quiet shores of her life. An explorer of another kind disembarked there one day in the shape of a young man to whom Paulina was primarily a kissable girl, with an afterthought in the shape of a grandfather. From the outset it had been impossible to fix Hewlett Winslow's attention on Dr. Anson. The young man behaved with the innocent profanity of infants sporting on a tomb. His excuse was that he came from New York, a Sumerian outskirt which survived in Paulina's geography, only because Dr. Anson had gone there once or twice to lecture. The curious thing was that she should have thought it worth while to find excuses for young Winslow. The fact that she did so had not escaped the attention of the village, but people, after a gasp of awe, said it was the most natural thing in the world that a girl like Paulina Anson should think of marrying. It would certainly seem a little odd to see a man in the house, but young Winslow would of course understand that the doctor's books were not to be disturbed, and that he must go down to the orchard to smoke. The village had barely framed this modus vivendi when it was convulsed by the announcement that young Winslow declined to live in the house on any terms. Hang going down to the orchard to smoke. He meant to take his wife to New York. The village drew its breath and watched. Did Persephone, snatched from the warm fields of Enna, peer half-consentingly down the abyss that opened at her feet? Paulina, it must be owned, hung a moment over the black gulf of temptation. She would have found it easy to cope with a deliberate disregard of her grandfather's rights, but young Winslow's unconsciousness of that shadowy claim was as much a natural function as the falling of leaves on a grave. His love was an embodiment of the perpetual renewal which to some tender spirits seems a crueler process than decay. On women of Paulina's mold this piety toward implicit demands, toward the ghosts of dead duties walking unappeased among usurping passions, has a stronger hold than any tangible bond. People said that she gave up young Winslow because her aunts disapproved of her leaving them, but such disapproval as reached her was an emanation from the walls of the house, from the bare desk, the faded portraits, the dozen yellowing tomes that no hand but hers ever lifted from the shelf. 2. After that the house possessed her. As if conscious of its victory, it imposed a conqueror's claims. It had once been suggested that she should write a life of her grandfather, and the task from which as he had shrunk, as from a too oppressive privilege now shaped itself into a justification of her course. In a burst of filial pantheism she tried to lose herself in the vast ancestral consciousness. Her one refuge from skepticism was a blind faith in the magnitude and the endurance of the idea to which as he had sacrificed her life, and with a passionate instinct of self-preservation she labored to fortify her position. The preparations for the life letter through byways that the most scrupulous of the previous biographers had left unexplored. She accumulated her material with a blind animal patience unconscious of fortuitous risks. The years stretched before her like some vast blank page spread out to receive the record of her toil, and as he had a mystic conviction that she would not die till her work was accomplished. The ants, sustained by no such high purpose, withdrew in turn to their respective divisions of the ants and lot, and Paulina remained alone with her task. She was 40 when the book was completed. As he had traveled little in her life, and it had become more and more difficult to her to leave the house even for a day, but the dread of entrusting her document to a strange hand made her decide to carry it herself to the publisher. On the way to Boston, as he had a sudden vision of the loneliness to which this last parting condemned her. All her youth, all her dreams, all her renunciations lay in that neat bundle on her knee. It was not so much her grandfather's life as her own that as he had written, and the knowledge that it would come back to her in all the glorification of print was of no more help than, to a mother's grief, the assurance that the lad she must part with will return with the Paulets. As he had naturally addressed herself to the firm which had published her grandfather's works. Its founder, a personal friend of the philosopher's, had survived the Olympian group of which he had been a subordinate member long enough to bestow his octogenarian approval on Paulina's pious undertaking. But he had died soon afterward, and Miss Anson found herself confronted by his grandson, a person with a brisk commercial view of his trade, who was said to have put new blood into the firm. This gentleman listened attentively, fingering her manuscript, as though literature were a tactile substance. Then, with a confidential twist of his revolving chair, he emitted the verdict: colon, we ought to have had this 10 years sooner. Miss Anson took the words as an allusion to the repressed avidity of her readers. It has been a long time for the public to wait, she solemnly assented. The publisher smiled. They haven't waited, he said. She looked at him strangely. H haven't waited? No, they've gone off, taken another train. Literature's like a big railway station now, you know. There's a train starting every minute. People are not going to hang round the waiting room. If they can't get to a place when they want to, they go somewhere else. The application of this parable cost Miss Anson several minutes of throbbing silence. At length she said, colon, then I am to understand that the public is no longer interested in my grandfather? She felt as though heaven must blast the lips that risked such a conjecture. Well, it's this way. He's a name still, of course. People don't exactly want to be caught not knowing who he is. But they don't want to spend $2 finding out when they can look him up for nothing in any biographical dictionary. Miss Anson's world reeled. She felt herself adrift among mysterious forces, and no more thought of prolonging the discussion than of opposing an earthquake with argument. She went home carrying the manuscript like a wounded thing. On the return journey she found herself traveling straight toward a fact that had lurked for months in the background of her life, and that now seemed to await her on the very threshold. The fact that fewer visitors came to the house. She owned to herself that for the last 4 or 5 years the number had steadily diminished. Engrossed in her work, as he had noted the change only to feel thankful that as he had fewer interruptions. There had been a time when, at the traveling season, the bell rang continuously, and the ladies of the house lived in a chronic state of silks and expectancy. It would have been impossible then to carry on any consecutive work, and she now saw that the silence which had gathered round her task had been the hush of death. Not of his death. The very walls cried out against the implication. It was the world's enthusiasm, the world's faith, the world's loyalty that had died. A corrupt generation that had turned aside to worship the brazen serpent. Her heart yearned with a prophetic passion over the lost sheep straying in the wilderness. But all great glories had their interlinear period, and in due time her grandfather would once more flash full-orbed upon a darkling world. The few friends to whom she confided her adventure reminded her with tender indignation that there were other publishers less subject to the fluctuations of the market, but much as he had braved for her grandfather. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.